Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. And welcome to the episode. Thanks for joining us. If this is the first time you've joined us, there's, I think, Kirk, we're up to like 355 episodes, 360, somewhere in there.
Yeah, we've been doing this quite a few years, Fred.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and we still haven't gotten any closer to agreeing on a couple of things. I think we both understand each other's position and know how to push each other's hot points.
Well, we came to reliability from different directions.
That's right.
I have to say.
But we do both like breaking stuff, so we have to admit that.
Yes, we do like that, and that's where we both agree we find out the most information, probably.
That's right.
It's when we break it.
That's right.
I'm always happy to hear you promote test of limits and empirical testing to find operational destruct limits, sometimes called HALT. Which we hate that definition, but we accept that everybody knows it. I call it empirical limit testing.
Yeah. And I call it discovery testing. You're a consultant. You're a consultant, aren't you? You're going to write a book with a three-letter acronym that you can call your own.
Right. But we all both agree.
Here's a question for you, and I suspect we're not going to agree on it. Right. So early on, I mentioned this idea, right, of, and I was just thinking of, and it was a question I got from a client the other day. Well, how reliable does our product need to be? Right. And they were asking of, well, does it have to have a 2% failure rate per year or better, or a 1% failure rate or better? And many times that discussion revolves around, well, what can you afford, right? I mean, what kind of, if you have a big, huge medical device product and you got a 200% profit margin, then half of them can fail, but then you run the risk of the customer saying, well, this doesn't work, I'm not going to use it anymore, and then you're out of business. So it's a business decision, first and foremost.
Sometimes, Fred, I don't agree that there is a direct correlation between cost and reliability of a product.
You can have a very
inexpensive product, like those now that, you know, greeting cards now that have a amplifier, battery, mm-hmm. can actually play songs,
right,
speaker, everything like that, and they're. I've picked them out from my garage and they're running 10 years later.
Yeah.
I open it up and they operate. So you're talking about a 10 cent, maybe 30 cent module at that.
Even both. Yeah.
So.
But the greeting card company, right? Now the greeting card company at some point said, oh, this is a cool idea. And it's probably some marketing guy or electrical engineering nerd that was in the company said, hey, let's do this. See what happens. And somebody said, well, will it last long enough to get on the shelf, to get to somebody's home and get to whoever is going to receive it?
And go through a mail distribution system in different countries, different places, whatever.
Yeah, whatever it is. And they kind of, if you're in that business, you kind of know what your travel times are and delivery times and storage times and all that stuff.
But you don't know. You're not going to know. Maybe you might know. But the actual environmental profile that product is going to have to go through to get to the customer and him for him to open up the, you know, the final recipient, open the card.
This is still a basic question though, as well.
If we do this,
but the other point of this thing is that, I mean, just right now, you and me are in different states. We have, mm-hmm. we had, as much as I love my Mac, I know that I can't convince you to get one. And we have different microphones. I'm using a little box that aggregates different lines, and I'm using different software. I've got an internet connection. There's modems and repeaters and switches and there's
a lot of hardware in between us.
That's right. A lot of hardware. And it's probably a good thing with some of our discussions that there's a lot of distance too. There's a lot of bits and pieces. So if I'm going to make a home router right? How reliable does that need to be? And now if you look at it from a system point of view, right? If we count, let's just assume that there's 20 subsystems between me and you, mm-hmm. probably products from 20 different companies, mm-hmm. right? Easily.
And maybe second sources to those.
Oh, I'm sure. Right. And so there's 20 parts.
Yes.
Right. And one of the objectives is that we're able to, you and I are able to get on the phone and, or on Skype is what we're using. And the software works, the hardware mm-hmm. works, you know, all these other things just work. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. part of this question is availability, right? But mm-hmm. these are all single point failure things. I think maybe some of the network stuff, internet stuff's got some redundancy to mm-hmm. our advantage. But everything in my house is single point, right? So it's just a series system. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think that whoever made this microphone that I'm talking into thought mm-hmm. about it in context of the overall system. They made a microphone that was of some reliability, right? Some probability of failure, probably to a large extent based on business needs and what the customers would accept.
Right. And they met the standard I/O, the conditions, the voltages, the signal strength, the varied, but even though there's variation in that.
Right. But they're saying that, you know, if they made a microphone, I was just talking to a person this morning on the phone, and their headset only had a 15-minute operating time, or 15 minutes. So when his headset failed, the call disconnected. And he called me back and says, I got another headset. I'm good for another half hour. Why are you using those things?
What?
Yeah.
And he knows it's going to fail in 30.
He knew it was 15, 20 minutes. It was going to go dead and it'd disconnect and he'd have to go get the other headset and hook it up. And
I'm like, what? Idea why?
That what would be yeah, why are we
15 minutes? Are you talking about battery?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I have any idea. I didn't get into it, but it was like,
yeah, that's bizarre.
The microphone maker doesn't, I mean, they just know that it should last, be available and work on demand for say 5 years, right? It's a consumer.
It shouldn't fail. There should be no acceptable failure rate in anything. Electronics.
Yeah. We saw that in quality, you know, the guys are saying zero defects. We're going to zero margin and all this stuff.
I know it's an ideal that can't be achieved.
Right. So what's good enough to ship? So when they want to qualify it and they want to advertise it and they want to market it and stuff,
yeah.
They're not going to come out and say, hey, we're going to sell you a microphone. It'll cost you $3. It'll last forever. Right? No, they don't do that because they know, and you and I both know, that won't happen. It's not going to last forever.
It may last technologically until it's obsolete.
I don't know.
Until you wouldn't want to use it.
At some point, eventually, even my little trusted, lovely little iPhone's going to get consumed when the sun goes into Nova. When our planet's hit by a satellite or by a rogue meteorite. Yeah, wow. It's going to fail. It will fail. And I'm saying forever. It's infinite.
Oh, I've got a lot of VCRs and things that will never fail. Okay. I've got.
Yeah. And then tell CD me about your. Yeah. Tell me about your.
They're not going to fail.
Tell me about your blenders.
Well, that's, that's another issue, but I think that's a poor design. And I don't know. It could be also a use environment. Maybe my wife has been harder than the average person
on
it.
She's a single person walking Hult machine for blendings. Yeah, exactly. So somebody comes to you, a client comes to you, or a friend of yours next door is working in a little startup and they've got this cool new product and stuff like that. And they don't know a whole lot about it. They know a little bit about how it's going to be used. And they say, well, how reliable does it need to be? So how do you, because they have to have some target, right? Because that influences how much effort they put into making sure their products have a reliable and stable source of components. They spend the money to get rid of the homemade soldering iron they have. They do some basic design for manufacturing for reliability.
Okay.
Right. But if they say, oh, it only has to last 38 seconds. I can use the cheapest whatever. I'll mock it together with some cardboard and Legos and I'm good, right? But if it really does need to last for a year or 5 years or 20 years with a relatively high percentage of reliability, that's a different game. You got to do different things to do it. So, but how do you answer that question for somebody? They're making a, like a microphone goes into a system.
Right.
How do you start with, well, this is a 6-month product or this is a 1-year product and it's got to be whatever.
I'd first understand what components are being used and if there are any that have an intrinsic failure mechanism or intrinsic wear out mechanism that is shorter than, say, you know, their 5 years. I say they want it to last 1 year mm-hmm. or 5 years. I'd say then let's see if the intrinsic mechanism has at least 20 years in it. And that would be, you know, mostly the semiconductors, solder, possibly. Is there anything in there that seems to be a weakness? Okay.
Oh, like,
and you know what that is. And if
hinges,
you don't,
like a hinge that wears every time it's used, or
okay,
bearings.
You're talking about
that,
a mechanic. You're talking about mechanics.
Yeah.
Yes. Those are measurable. Those are measurable wear. Those are things that you can do accelerated life tests that actually consume material that you can actually measure by dimension or weight or something.
How about capacitor drift? Or what do they call it? Ripple current and it starts overheating this stuff, and that creates internal heating and degrades the capacitance of it.
Let me qualify my statement about solid state electronics. Aluminum electrolytic capacitors do have a finite life in them because of the liquid it's used, electrolyte, in the actually sealed container. Mm-hmm. That is one of the very few passive components, and there are substitutions for that. There are other capacitance.
Yeah. How about optocouplers?
Optocouplers, yes. LEDs will decline in their intensity and whatever.
There's no moving parts.
There's no moving parts, but eventually, but as I've said, the technological obsolescence of that product. This is what I don't think engineers are very able to see and predict the future for. They may have invented, you know, VCRs to last 10 years, if you can find one now, or DVD players or CD players to last 10 years. But they didn't realize that the whole streaming and internet was going to be much faster and allow for streaming of virtually everything from music to movies to everything. And that there's no reason for us to go to a Redbox. There's no reason for us to do Netflix by mail anymore. In fact, Netflix, I don't even really send out DVDs anymore. I guess they probably do, but they're streaming everything. And Amazon Prime, everybody, all these services. And so, you know, as we talked about earlier, DVDs are the Redboxes destined to be, and removable media and media in general is going to be absent in the next few years.
Yeah, I had a thought. Maybe those red boxes will deliver rotisserie chickens because they're usually outside of a grocery store.
Well, you need something very thin, maybe round.
Chicken breasts then.
Tortillas.
Tortillas, yeah, yeah. And then cook it on the way out. Yeah,
something like that. Because there are going to be a lot of red boxes that don't have anything to do. You know, there's nobody to do that anymore. And DVD players are going to go away too, the same reason the red boxes.
Yeah, but you're saying those, the DVD players themselves, the electronics and the sound delivery will still work.
Oh, yeah. The mechanics, you know, in my car, okay. I have a Honda 2012 Pilot. And okay, as we talked about earlier, there's so many ways now to interface to get music or to play programs on your thing. You've got USB, you've got XM radio, I've got a hard disk in there, you've got a USB connector where you could put on a flash drive or your phone.
Or streaming, right? You got an internet connection and stream it in. Yeah.
All that stuff. And you've got so many options. Of course, I don't use XM radio. I've got tons of music and my podcast. I plug in my phone. I listen to my podcast recorded previously. I've got so much material. I can't listen to it all. So, but as far as reliability goes, the thing that's broken in that thing is the CD eject.
Yeah.
A mechanical system that lifts up the CD, pushes it out the slot. Now, that slot was cute and cool, but obviously the motor or the rollers that pull it out will no longer grip the edge of the CD and pull it out. And I've actually stuck my I've stuck a stick in there with some
adhesive on it and grabbed it and pull it out.
Yeah, to grab it and pull it out. And, you know, if I ever sell it. But you don't need a CD. You can go put a USB flash drive with 5,000 songs on it.
All right, but still, every single one of those products you talked about, and every technology, all the various types of media, at some point, it was the thing, and they had to last some period of time, right?
It had to last some period of time.
Right, but how do you know how long and how many have to last? How do you quantify that answer to somebody?
Well, these are kind of questions that can't be really – I mean – tell me the future. You know, it's the whole crystal ball question. Tell me about when I'm going to die and how I'm going
to
die.
Well, we can go talk to actuaries and they give you a lot of probabilities exactly.
Right. They give you some very big probabilities,
right.
But they can't tell how you're going to die.
I don't know if they can or not. I think the Social Security number guys are holding back on us, but they know because they have to answer a very real question of, well, how much insurance premium should we charge so that if too many people die, we don't go broke, right? I'm just thinking actuarially and it's the same question we have to answer in a company, right? If we're going to send out the new, greatest, latest media thingy or box or microphone or whatever,
But we can't test humans to limits.
No. Well, it's been done, but it's been frowned on.
Killing electronics is easy, and I don't have any moral problem with it.
Right. But I'm not getting an answer here, Kurt. If somebody says, hey, we got this widget, right? Widget A. And we need to know, one, how reliable should we try to get it to? And then I know what your answer is.
Okay.
And then two, how do we know? What's our evidence at the end of the day, the final design review, that we're going to make our 2% failure rate per year, which now all our financial models are built on, our investors are counting on,
right.
It's compatible with the market or whatever. We say, how do we know that got there? And if we go to Halt, right, you and I do agree that you really can't predict that you're going to be at a 2% failure rate for the first year.
Fred,
but how reliable does it need to be?
There's any test that tells you how long it will last because you're based on it's a very limited number of samples relative to usually any product population, except in some cases.
So you're saying you can't answer it?
I'm saying that unless I could answer it if you give me 300 units, I get to test in 5 different potential conditions that I want to do that need to be done, that I can find all of its weaknesses, and then I can have time to model that weakness that if you don't want to remove it or improve it, that I can tell you, quantify it, how long it's going to last. That is going to be the leading mechanism, so that's going to cause the most failures, and maybe I can do that. But instead, I would say a better strategy is let's remove all the weak links to it. Then all we really have to worry about is manufacturing consistency, which is not guaranteed. And the supply chains are not guaranteed. Right. And I can't control that. And you can't control that. And nobody can control the future of that. And you may have a supplier in production of a certain component. You can't control that. You may have to switch to a different supplier of a different component. You may have to put a substitute. All these things, it's just like it's not frozen. There's a distribution over time and in time of each supplier's
capability. Well, then let me ask it this way. I need to know, hypothetically, widget X, right? And I come to you and I say, you know, we believe the market wants it to last at least a year, and that's what we're going to set a warranty for, right?
And I would say, what's going to fail in less than a year on this? What do you guys
suspect? Oh, you and I could sit there and we could sit there and name 100 things. Yeah.
Well, I would say to the designers, what is your feeling that the weakest part of this design is or the least life in this design? And you tell me, and then I'll go out and say, let's accelerate that mechanism. Okay. Mm-hmm. If they know in advance.
A lot of times they do.
Okay, then let's accelerate that specific mechanism and focus on that and how we can maybe improve it at very little cost at this stage of the game, hopefully, okay. at early stages. Again, at where when you test and when you find the problems is very critical to whether you can address them cost effectively.
Right.
And so that's you know, my idea is getting them off to off of quantification in the crystal ball sense that this, you know, 1%, 5%, let's our goal be no percent. We know that can't be reached. Zero defects. We know that can't be reached.
I know. I still need to answer the finance guys saying they need to set aside money for warranty.
Right. And let's look at the last product. Unless you're a brand new company or never known.
This is your neighbor, Widget X,
previous data in the field, a similar type product or similar thing. And somehow, if you can squirm out, and these aren't given out, you know, you really never can get reliability failure percentages from any company because they won't ever tell you. But if you have a product or you know somebody that's in the industry, can give you general numbers without naming names, and you could probably base that. And it probably, you know, if everything's the same, you're using the same manufacturers like a Foxconn or a MSI or somebody like that over in China, you know, that you've been using, you're probably going to have a similar manufacturing defect rate. And you can kind of go on that and say, well, if it's, you know, based on the last product you had out there and you saw about a 5% warranty return rate during this period of time, although it was quite bumpy, of course, it's not a smooth line. It changes dynamically all the time. Then that's probably a general point to start with. The next thing is find out what those products causing those products to fail in 5%.
And go fix it. Yeah. But so the company comes back to you and says, well, 5% is too high. We got to get it at 2.5%. I'm an aggressive manager. We're going to set a stretch goal.
How about let's go with 0% and see what we come up with? Why are we saying it can, you know, this is again, why are we saying that 2% is acceptable? Why would any percentage be acceptable?
Because I can afford to make it. If I need to prove that I'm at 0%, right?
Okay.
I'm stuck.
Okay, Fred, this is where I'm kind of going to say that, look, cost doesn't necessarily there's not a correlation between cost and reliability. Okay, I don't think there's a direct correlation. You would maybe say, well, let's buy more capable parts.
No. I'm saying what I mean is not the cost. I'm not saying the cost of the parts. I'm saying that in order to claim that I have zero defects on a product package, where now I'm held to that, right?
Right.
And you don't see that in products, right? They say it's very reliable, but they don't define it. But the point is that if my manager said you want to be at zero defects and I want to prove that I'm at zero defects, right? Even if I define it to within 1 year with the certain failure mechanism or anything else, I need an infinite number of samples run for longer than a year to have enough evidence to say, yeah, it's there.
Right.
Or to design it, to say every single component has a chance of being assembled wrong or manufactured wrong or have latent damage or wear out or be abused or whatever. There's a finite chance, even though in many, many cases, it's very, very, even your old DVD players, every component has a finite probability of failing any given moment. It's not zero. It can fail, but it's usually so small that it lasts longer than we expect.
Exactly.
Right. So guy comes to you and says, I want to prove that it will have zero failures for the first year. Right. And that's where I'm talking about the cost comes into is going until you're at the 109th probability of failure and showing that is horribly expensive. And if you want to design it to do that, then it's like triple or quadruple redundancy. And even then, you can still have a finite probability of failing.
Right. That is all to prove to somebody. That is not – that's the in doing the statistical-based testing that would be required, okay?
Right. And that's what I'm saying. If you claim
okay. –
well,
so if now, you want to know it's okay and to verify that.
Yeah, if you want to verify it. But if I set a goal – right. If you set a goal and you don't measure it, it's just a slogan. It doesn't mean anything. It's like, we're shooting for zero defects, but 50% is okay because we're thinking about zero defects. I don't buy this that you can say 2% is not good enough. It's a business reality that I can't prove. I don't want a 50% failure rate.
That's the question.
I want a 2% failure rate. Yeah.
That's prove. Now you're talking about the cost of proving it.
Right, right. That's okay, that's what I've been talking about the whole time. Right.
Okay, okay.
For 2 days now, I've been talking about
it. You can only prove it from the time point standpoint of that build, that particular combination of supplier components.
You could always do
and that day.
Yeah, you could always do the Microsoft Microsoft method. Ship it to your customers and see how many fail.
Well,
I say that facetiously because I know they do a lot of testing. But you know, when you do a million beta testers, I mean, come on. Costs you more to figure out who's talking to you than
exactly. But you know, that's it is requiring in beta testing of software, it requiring so many different combinations of, you know, computer systems and things that it's really a good idea. They can't possibly test it
in all circumstances,
all the possible different machines on the, right. in the world, thousands, millions of computers. But
unless you're Microsoft, though, you do some due diligence in house just to protect your brand. Right. And so that adds to the cost.
And before Microsoft releases their beta, they do, I'm sure, a lot of testing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they release their beta and say, with a warning, we haven't finished this. And so be aware, back up your data and let's go, you know, you run this and see what you think. But of course, a lot of times software doesn't cause a permanent catastrophic failure of your hardware.
But so the point is, so the cost I'm talking about is the cost of sitting in that final design review and having more than just go, oh, I feel good about this, let's ship it. Because I've run into it over and over and over again. I want some evidence, some convincing evidence that we're not shipping a product that they're all going to fail in a week.
And I will do a whole different frame of reference and a whole different approach than anybody that's quantified it past or given rates of failure. I'd say, let's look at the device. Let's look at what can fail in it. Let's look at your field history of your previous product or a similar product. Let's find out what those mechanisms were. Let's test those mechanisms. In fact, let's emphasize testing those particular mechanisms we've seen fail in the field and past products. Let's look at any limiting components that mechanical components that will eventually have consumption of material and make sure they have enough reservoir material, such as conductor, platings, things like that. Then let's verify that this has as much strength as one of our reliable products, or let's find out that it operates to the fundamental limits of what current standard technologies are. And that, for me, is generally above or around for a circuit board with no other moving parts and no intrinsic and no thermal shutdowns, that a board can operate at least 100°C. You know, and you benchmark it and you come up with a benchmark after you have experience in doing this and you've done it a few times with products. And this is, you know, trying to keep this consistent in a company is very hard to do because of the high rate of turnover in the technological engineering fields. But having that history of this product reached 135, our next product only goes to 85°C and has problems would say, you know, let's investigate.
We got to solve something
this.
Here. Yeah.
We got to look at it, see what it is. It may be something we can easily change. And, you know, maybe I've seen it as small as a diode from a an eighth of a watt to a quarter of a watt at 30° margin to something. So that's not a big, that wouldn't be a few pennies difference in a $1,000 machine. So, you know, it doesn't correlate. And I think if you look at the history.
Well, you're talking about cost of bill of material.
Cost of material. Yeah. Now, obviously, any change in the design is going to have other administrative costs, paperwork, bombs, things like that. So, yes, there's going to be additional costs other than just the raw cost of materials. But certainly.
I think you got another whole topic here that I'm going to come back to you on another podcast. You know, I think it's too little, too late. And my argument is it's not convincing enough. But I think there is a valid argument.
Why is it too late?
Because I'm going to ship next week, and you're saying that all we know is that we fixed a few things.
That's the problem. If you wait until you're going to ship a week before you ship, then yeah, you're going to be in trouble.
What? Do you get prototypes early? You got some? Yes. That might be the real topic. Is how do you get prototypes?
Yeah. Typically where there was three stages of prototypes.
All right. We got to talk about that separate then.
Okay. Right.
So my original thought was, well, how reliable does a product need to be? And I'm trying to put a number on it. It's got to have a 98% reliable over a year. And you're saying, nah, don't worry. Just say, aim for as few and as minimal number as you can get. And that's as good as you can get. So it's make
with
it robust.
Know,
yeah. Make it as robust as you can.
It's going to last longer than you need it to last.
Right.
That technological obsolescence will soon make it turned off.
Don't
and
worry.
Salvaged.
Yeah. Don't worry. Somebody's going to invent something, put you out of business.
Well, you're going to invent something. You're the company you're working for. You're going to invent a new model you want to sell, right? So
you got to make sure the current one fails?
No, you want to make sure the new one has so much technological benefits and features and capability beyond your previous product that they're not going to want that previous product. It's not because it failed. You certainly don't want that because you're going to certainly have a negative experience, a customer with a negative experience.
Oh, I know.
He's going to think twice. So
you're not off to buy the new iPhone, though. And it's way better than the one you have.
By what?
No, they said it yesterday. We were recording this on a couple of days after the new iPhone launch on Wednesday.
Yeah.
You know, just listen to the thing. It's newer and greater and better and bolder, and it smells good, and it goes through washing machines, and it whitens your teeth. And I mean, it did everything.
But Fred, I look at those and I say, what can Apple do, and what can these smartphone companies do? I mean, other than holographic projections or something, I'm waiting for something.
Oh,
like
there's 3D camera stuff coming, and virtual reality stuff, processors and artificial intelligence in there. And
I think the virtual reality they have is pretty cool on an iPhone. Have you ever done these VR? I have a little viewing
VR
glasses.
Yeah,
but the resolution, now that's what I'm expecting, that they need to get a very much higher resolution for it to be usable. But it's a pretty amazing stuff. I mean, if you've downloaded that, I encourage everybody to go buy the little headset and use your iPhone, and you just get amazing things. Yeah.
It's pretty cool. It's coming.
Yeah. And it will be better. So anyway.
So that's what it's going to take for you to get the new phone then, I guess.
Significant.
But it's slowing down with phones, and other technologies are picking up. The virtual reality is certainly still very fast turnover. And we talked about that. And you wrote about it and stuff. So anyway, thanks for listening or putting up with us. It might be another way to put it up.
Our active discussion.
But if you come down on one way or the other, how would you answer this question? How reliable does your product need to be? And then if your boss immediately then says, well, how do you prove it? How do you show that? How do we know that we're good to ship? Those are valid questions, and I hear them all the time.
Right. And then if they answer that, how many years is it going to be before the Earth is going to be hit by a catastrophic asteroid? Please tell me.
Yeah, I think that was like in 19, wasn't it 19? There was a couple of times in the 1900s we were supposed to end the world. There was another one a couple of weeks ago, I think. But anyway, yeah.
We'd all like to predict the future.
Yeah,
for sure.
That's our business. That's what we do. So please let us know. We'd love to hear from you over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And it's a page on the site really just for you to join the conversation. Let us know your thoughts, your comments, suggestions for future topics, solutions for getting Kirk and I to actually agree on something or more things, something like that. That would be great. So anyway, thanks, Kirk. Always a lively discussion. We'll be back. I got a couple more ideas jotted down.
Okay, Fred. Enjoyed it.
All right. Thanks, Kirk. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.